This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
The sun hangs low in the sky. A soft strain of jazz swells in the air, mingling with the gentle rustle of leaves and the breeze. Chris, our protagonist, stands tall under a canopy of flowers, his blue eyes twinkling in the golden late light of a summer's day. But Chris is nervous. His heart is racing. And then, all of a sudden, there she is. Time seems to slow and flex as the woman he loves walks towards him. In that moment, it dawns on him. He's found his soulmate. That something is about to spoil it all. Chris wakes up. The meadow is gone, replaced instead by the cold underside of a computer desk.
Would I describe myself as lucky in love? No.
I'm Hannah Fry, a mathematician who studies patterns in human behaviour, and this is Uncharted, Tales of Data and Discovery. This is a series about how numbers and graphs can help you to map the invisible, about how plots can be rich with hidden depths and unheard stories, and about how sometimes, if you know where to look, there is mystery and drama and intrigue to be found, all concealed within a few simple lines on a page. Our story starts in the city of Los Angeles. Chris McKinley has woken up in a small, cramped cubicle, a desktop computer, his only companion. He was in the final sprint of a 6-year PhD at UCLA and had been there so often that he'd done something drastic. Chris had given up his apartment and was living in his cubicle. For 5.5 years, he had been feverishly trying to advance a new technology called high-dimensional clustering. But the intense work was losing its luster. Chris had just turned 31. He was certainly not old, but he wasn't getting any younger. Surely, he thought, there's got to be more to life than this.
By year 6, I was wanting to actually meet someone and start a serious relationship, and that's not what is happening.
Chris had been making some effort to get out there. Like many of us, he had a carefully honed online persona, a shinier, funnier, slightly taller version of the real thing. There were 2 million women in LA, and they had no idea that he was sleeping in a cubicle. Maybe one of them would see some potential.
And there's these, like, many kind of emotional cycles of, like, thinking, oh, wow, this person seems really cool. And then, of course, you write them and they don't write you back.
In 9 months of online dating, Chris had matched with less than 100 women. He had spent hours tweaking his profile, selecting pictures, answering the dating site's questions. And on paper, he was kind of a catch. Just 31, 6 foot tall, blue-eyed, with a PhD and a love of music. But despite it all, his profile remained abysmally unloved. Chris started to wonder whether the problem lay not so much with him, but with the site itself.
I probably was not the top hit, even for someone in LA who was searching for, like, nerdy guys 6 feet tall with blue eyes. I probably wasn't anywhere near the top. I realized that I had the visibility problem.
If Chris wasn't coming up on other people's searches, his profile might as well be invisible, and that would reduce his odds of matching, well, anyone, to practically zero. And then another thought hit him, something that tickled his mathematical brain.
If you understand how the search engine works, well, you could plausibly just kind of short circuit, like, almost the whole dating application, you know? If I can just maximize my search ranking and the results to any search that's run, what if I could actually reach the top of every single search, not only for nerdy guys with blue eyes, but literally for like any heterosexual male.
It was a big ask, but if Chris could do it, he would stand a real chance of finally meeting a stranger who might change the rest of his life. He starts with the basics. How does this algorithm actually work? What does it use to match people? It was based on a series of multiple choice questions. You could answer as many or as few as you wanted, and the algorithm would preferentially show you people whose answers best matched your own.
You know, 98% of the questions like only had maybe 10 people sort of answering them. But there were a few questions that almost every single person answered.
Chris thinks of his own profile. When he had set it up, he had selected and answered questions at random. But what if he had unknowingly selected questions that were unpopular? Well, that could explain everything. If just 10 people had answered the same questions as him, his dating pool wasn't just small, it was tiny. No wonder his matches were so low. 2 weeks later, Chris was gearing up to push a button. He was about to release an army of bots onto a group of unsuspecting women with just one aim.
To create profiles, gather data, and then delete themselves.
The dating site had a tiny vulnerability that Chris hoped he could exploit. If your questions and answers had matched someone else's perfectly, then their profile would appear on a list as you logged in. And that meant that if Chris built thousands and thousands of fake profiles, each trying different combinations of answers to different questions, once their matches had been revealed, the dating site would effectively be telling him how many women had answered in the same way. And not only that, because the site revealed who these women were, Chris could use his bots to visit each of their profiles and collect detailed data on what kinds of women were answering different types of questions. He had found a way to scrape thousands of profiles, logging every attribute, age, ethnicity, sexuality, height, smoker or non-smoker, star sign, and everything they each cared about and wanted in a partner.
So the more I thought about that, the more compelling the idea seemed. And I started using all of my time to download and analyze match data.
He turned to a little algorithm called K-Modes, which he'd used in his PhD. This program could take vast amounts of data, sprinkle it across a graph in many, many dimensions. It could search for patterns and create clusters. K-Modes had first been used to identify noxious soybeans, but Chris hoped that maybe it could find groups of like-minded singles too. And then he saw something. Seven beautiful coloured clusters were waiting patiently between three axes on the screen. Each of them represented a distinct kind of woman, a personality type, a set of interests, and a unified idea of what their next relationship was going to look like. K-Modes had worked.
When it actually worked, it quickly became a very, very exciting prospect.
Chris immediately selected a sample of names from one of the larger clusters and clicked through to their dating profiles. All of them were highly religious. As an atheist, Chris thought he'd better leave that group well alone. What would the second cluster hold? Well, this group was clearly new to the dating scene, and many of them were looking for one-night stands. But Chris was here for the long haul. The third, fourth, and fifth clusters were all out of his age bracket, which was 25 to 45. They were either too young or too old. Now there were only two clusters left, number six and number seven. Could either of those be right? Number six certainly piqued his curiosity. These women were professional, working as editors or designers, but there was something about the seventh group that captured his imagination. Many of them had tattoos or liked them. They were musicians or successful artists. They were creative, not for a living, but for themselves. Chris had found what he was looking for, a golden cluster. Perhaps hidden somewhere inside it would be the love of his life. Chris was, of course, initially pleased, but This wasn't his primary problem. What would be the point of identifying the women he liked if they didn't know he even existed? And so Chris got to work on a new hero profile. On signing up, the site suggested question after question, but he would only answer the 1,000 questions that had also been answered by women in that golden cluster. And even then, only using answers he knew they were looking for. He didn't lie. He just leaned into the traits he now knew would make him appear most attractive. Months of work had been building to this very moment.
The whole time I was doing that, I was like, this probably isn't going to work. This is a huge waste of time. What are you doing?
Doubting himself, Chris closed the site. He shut down his laptop and he folded himself under the desk. It was time to get some sleep.
That's the point at which events kind of started to take their own course. And I think I stopped really being in control of this and kind of getting swept along by
it. His profile was being matched with women all over the city. Messages and emails would not stop flooding in. He'd actually done it. Now what?
I wasn't really prepared to sort through all the kind of human consequences.
No longer were these profiles on a screen, but real people who could judge and reject him. And then there was the problem of the dates themselves. How many could he take before he'd burn out completely?
If you scale that up to like 5 nights a week, it's going to seriously affect you. But, you know, carpe diem, man.
Chris decided he would go on one date a day. Some of the early ones were romantic, long walks down the Venice canals, fancy dinners on rooftops. But as time went on, they were becoming downright wild. He began to meet women in sports cars and was invited to parties that would make Bret Easton Ellis proud. At first, it was fun.
But that didn't last all that long. I burnt out after maybe a month of 4 or 5 nights a week going on like serious dates.
By July of 2012, Chris had gone on 80 first dates in just 5 weeks.
I was lagging. You could often meet 3 or 4 people, even just in a single weekend, who are fairly similar. And like, the question is, are you going to stop doing this?
The novelty was wearing off. Chris would be going on his 88th first date. If this didn't work soon, the dream would be over. He would shut everything down.
And then, of course, like, I met someone worth shutting it down for.
In a small coffee shop right next to the UCLA campus, Christine Tien Wang had made an immediate impression.
She was honest to the point of bluntness. I could tell immediately she was extremely competitive and ambitious. I was infatuated by that. It was kind of, I don't want to say it was love at first sight, but it was like a very strong magnetic attraction very early. And maybe it's going to be like a 50-50 call. Maybe it won't work out and I'll be back here in 6 months.
So did it work out? Did Chris actually hack one of the biggest dating sites in the world and find true love? Well, sounds a bit too good to be true.
But we've been, you know, happily together for almost 11 years. And like, thank God. And it's good. Yeah, life is good.
Perhaps love really is a numbers game after all. I love a happy ending, don't you?
Next on Uncharted for Discovery, a young researcher's seemingly minor mistake uncovers a scandal of epic proportions.
It's spring in San Diego, California, and PhD student Mark Besh is feeling nervous. He's made it up the steps to the stage without falling over and fired up his PowerPoint. In a precise Swiss-German accent, he starts his carefully prepared presentation. He needs this to go well. The research he's sharing is nothing fancy, just a small study conducted with 2 others on a shoestring budget. But this audience is full of potential employers and people who can give out lucrative research contracts. And he's worried they'll judge him poorly. Because as he comes to the end of his talk, one slide is projected onto the huge screen. It's a simple bar chart, but some of the bars are much, much higher than the others. He's not quite sure how to explain the results. He knows that they are odd, but that is the data they got. He tries to justify it to himself. After all, his group was commissioned to run the tests and record the outcomes, not to explain them. The presentation goes well. In the follow-up questions, no one challenges the methods or the results. Another study done and delivered, and now Mark can relax. What he doesn't know, the data that Mark and his colleagues captured will have seismic implications for a global industry. It's several years earlier, January 2002. An aspiring engineer, Hemanth Kapana, is reluctantly embarking on an adventure.
I'd never even traveled out of Bangalore, let alone the state Karnataka.
He's on his way from his family home in southern India to the USA.
What am I signing up for? I'm happy at home. Mom cooks food and she does my laundry. And what am I going to do? I don't even know to cook.
Hemanth is heading to West Virginia to study for a master's. But when he arrives, the campus city of Morgantown is not quite what he'd hoped.
Man, I was like, wait a minute, where did I land? It's like a smaller than a village in India. It has got four streets and all you see is a bunch of students.
What West Virginia did have to offer was a university with an engineering specialism, in particular, automotive engineering. And a few years later, that's what drew two others to make the same journey. Arvind Thiruvengadam from India and from Switzerland, Mark Besch, our speaker with the bar chart. By 2012, all three men were bright young PhD students working together on a new study into the emissions of an exciting new batch of cars. These days, diesel cars are on their way out. But there was a time when they were the planet's greatest new green hope. And for good reason. Diesel engines are actually much more efficient than petrol. Per mile, they produce much less carbon dioxide. And diesel is a lot cheaper, which sounds great, right? But unfortunately, there is quite a big downside. Diesel engines spit out other stuff too, and in particular, lots of nasty gases called NOx, a blend of nitrogen oxides. And NOx is really bad news. It can cause the build-up of dense smog, it's damaging to the lungs, it's linked to asthma and to acid rain. Now, there is a fix for this. There are ways of cleaning up diesel emissions, but they come with a cost. Here's Arvind.
Because of the complexity of the exhaust cleanup system, it was not economically viable for most of the North American car manufacturers to introduce diesel vehicles into the American market.
And so, for decades in the US, diesel engines had only been found in heavy-duty vehicles like trucks. But that left an enticing opportunity. If a car manufacturer could find a way to remove those nasty NOx gases cheaply, well, they would suddenly open up access to a whole new segment of the consumer market, diesel vehicles for everyday drivers. And then, around 2008, one company finally cracked it.
It created a lot of hype because now one of the OEM had broken that technology barrier and is now able to introduce a diesel passenger car. And what was more lucrative was that it was in that $30,000 range. None of the diesel cars at that point had breached that $30,000 range.
This was a huge breakthrough, a cheap, clean diesel. For the company, it promised engineering kudos and huge profits. For regulators and governments, it promised cleaner air and greener cars. Over at California's regulator, the Air Resources Board, Alberto Ayala and his engineers were pumped.
We fully believed in the promise of clean diesel. If you apply the emission control technology, the catalysts that control NOx, it's great technology.
The airways were quickly flooded with slick, funny adverts to let the world know clean diesel cars had arrived.
TDI set a Guinness World Record 58 miles per gallon.
Boasting a 2-liter TDI turbocharged clean diesel engine with 140...
Diesel, it's no longer a dirty word.
By late 2012, Hemanth, Mark and Arvind are barreling down the freeway in LA, taking turns at the wheel, testing out cars and collecting data. They've travelled to California, rented some vehicles and rigged up their own emissions testing setup. The cars look like something out of Ghostbusters.
There are tubes and pipes coming out of the trunk, and there were adapters mounted behind the vehicle that connected to the exhaust. So when we got quite a bit of comments from people who really were surprised what we are doing.
A tube from the tailpipe carried a sample of exhaust gases into a high-tech emissions testing box that was crammed awkwardly into the trunk. And that was powered by a noisy petrol fuel generator on the back seat that was venting its exhaust out of the window. It was clumsy, noisy and uncomfortable, but it was working.
All we had in our mind was like, get more data. We would put like 10 to 14 hours easily.
As they drove, the data flowed. And quite quickly, the team noticed that something was off. For two of the cars, the NOx emissions were much too high. But maybe their setup was too clumsy. Maybe it was affecting the engines.
So what we did was we tested the exact setup that we tested on the road. We did the exact setup in the lab. So if it functioned poorly on the road, it should function poorly in the lab as well. But it did really good in the lab.
That was puzzling. In the lab, cars were placed on a kind of treadmill. It's the most precise method, exactly the approach used by regulators. But there were still other possibilities. Engines are sensitive to all sorts of different conditions out on the road. It could be any number of things that they couldn't control. And so after days and days of driving and collecting data, the small budget now exhausted, they moved on to other projects.
It was just sitting around without knowing what kind of potential this little report had. Oh, man.
Two full years later, in 2014, Mark has finally analysed the data and stood up to give his presentation at the Hyatt Regency in San Diego. Up on the screen, that odd bar chart, the bars tracking NOx emissions from the on-road tests tower above those from the lab. There in the audience was Alberto Ayala, the California Air Resources Regulator. And he knew straight away that something wasn't right.
And I do remember vividly because it was really the first time where the complete set of results were all presented in a way that was painting a very clear picture.
For Alberto, this signaled a big problem.
And we took the findings that Mark presented in 2014, and we turned this into an actual compliance and enforcement investigation.
So Alberto and his team of engineers at the California Air Resources Board began a careful and quiet investigation of their own. They had more manpower, more resources, more years of expertise than Mark, Arvind and Hemanth. But they were getting the same results. What was going on? In his public talk, Mark had held back one key piece of information. Researchers strive for objectivity to avoid the biases of branding. And so, as was customary, Mark had not identified the make and model of the badly performing cars. He referred to them simply as vehicles A and B. But Alberto knew exactly who was responsible.
Volkswagen.
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 Volkswagen. Das Auto.
By 2014, Volkswagen was a multinational corporation worth over $100 billion, and it was fast catching up with Toyota, the biggest car company in the world. Alberto had dealt with people from Volkswagen for years. He knew they had excellent engineers. There must be an explanation.
They try to give us information that sounded and smelled and tasted like real answers to the problems when every time that we would try to verify what they were telling us, we would come up with more unknowns.
Just as he was considering his next move, at a conference, a senior Volkswagen executive tapped him on the shoulder.
He approached me and said, you know, can we talk? You know, we, after dinner, the last day of the conference, you know, we walked away from the crowd and found a space and And in so many words, Stuart Johnson basically admitted that they were cheating.
It was an extraordinary admission. Johnson revealed that Volkswagen's clean diesels were using a defeat device. Buried in the car's software, they had built in a devious trick. The car would detect when it was being tested in a lab and immediately ramp up the NOx removal technology, temporarily cleaning the emissions. Regulators relied on lab tests, but Volkswagen had been cheating for years. As soon as their cars were out on the road, the NOx cleaning system would be disabled, and the cars would pump out these nasty gases up to 35 times more than promised, exactly as Mark's bar chart revealed.
It shook me, and I remember going back to my cabin, to my hotel room, and just laying in bed, looking at the ceiling, going, you know, there's no way. I also felt a very strong sense of betrayal.
Tonight, we have learned that the Department of Justice is opening a criminal investigation into a scheme by the world's largest car company.
The repercussions would take years to play out in full. In the US, Volkswagen was hit with billions of dollars of fines and was forced to recall or buy back almost 500,000 cars from unsuspecting customers. Around the world, the total cost of the scandal topped $34 billion. In September 2015, a public acknowledgement and an apology.
So let's be clear about this. Our company was dishonest with the EPA and the California Air Resources Board. And in my German words, we have totally screwed up.
Around the globe, Volkswagen sold nearly 11 million cars with the defeat devices installed. A scandal not just for a world-beating company, but for the planet. Discovered thanks to a few bars on a graph.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt. For things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.